First of all, I wanted to just thank, we have a lot of sponsors today, and I really wanted to thank everybody for partaking and being part of this share. We first of all to Barbara Lehman and to Yitzhak Siegel, in memory of Barbara's mother. This is actually the first yahrzeit of her mother, Sarah Ann Lehman, Sarah Bas Yitzhak Meshulam Feish, and Chaya Chana Ada Alea Shalom. So I was at the Leviah last year just at this time. And a tremendous person, obviously involved in community on many, many different levels, as you know, the Lehman's in our shul, but also more broadly in the community, it should be in Aliyas Neshama. Also, we have a special sponsorship this morning in honor of David's birthday. From Ariella, Racheli, Eliana, and Gabi, in honor of the birthday, and Metz Hashem, it should be many more, in Gesund, and in great Hatzlacha, David, Metz Hashem. Today we also want to thank Esther and Baruch for sponsoring for the occasion of the yahrzeit of Baruch's mother, Gittel Bas Zanvil Dov, Mrs. Gladys Weinstein, Aleha HaShalom, whose yahrzeit is actually Boy Bayom, this very day itself, 29 years, and we also wish at the same time Nechama to Baruch's father, who's also just getting up of Shiva from his wife's here's the picture of his wife, and this is obviously Baruch and Esther are very much a integral part of our shul. Baruch had a comment on the video, the shul video, which is a very special comment, which is that a shul is a place where volunteering makes you into a better person, and I think it really speaks a lot about Baruch himself and the entire Weinstein Mishpacha. And finally, we want to thank Michael and Karen, who are sponsoring for Michael's mother's yahrzeit, Mrs. Harriet Rosenblum, Henya Chemda, Bas Shmuel, it's Chemda or Chemda, Bas Shmuel, and I've been to numerous siyumim, and in terms of the Limud Torah that has gone on for her Aliyas Neshama, it's a schus to be continuing to learn for her Aliyas Neshama. We're also learning for the Refuah Shlema of Ron Pesach Ben Henya, and let's start learning. Thank you very much for being for contributing and for being part of this process. Let's learn together. We're in this interesting in between stage. We've just come out of Purim. We left Sefer Shmos. We're about to enter Pesach, but we shouldn't be starting to learn about Pesach yet, because there's going to be lots of time to learn about Pesach, God willing, in the next few weeks. So next week, just to sort of see where we're going. Next week is going to be the history of Mechiras Chametz. The week afterwards is going to be putting Seder into your Seder, and then it's going to be Pesach. So that's just the next 3 weeks. This week we're going to spend a little bit of time focusing on Sefer Vayikra, because we had that opportunity in this little window to think about Vayikra. So actually, when I put together these sources, I was thinking in a particular direction. I actually changed the way I was thinking after they were printed. We're going to go a little bit out of order just for the sake of a different way of thinking about things. So this has been an evolution. I'd like to start on page 2 at the source 4. This is a pasuk from this week's parasha. There's much to take from Korbanos, even though Korbanos are not extant in the way that they were in the Beis Hamikdash. Nonetheless, there's a lot we can learn from them. So the first thing we're going to take a look at is the following command that the Torah says. V'chol korban minchasecha. All the korbanos of your mincha. A mincha is a grain offering, right? So it's a meal offering. There's numerous types of grain offerings, and it says the following: Bamelach timlach. You should surely salt it. That means you need to put salt onto your korbanos. But tashpis melach bris elokecha me'al minchasecha. Don't let it rest. In other words, don't let the salt not be there. Of the covenant on your menachos, on your meal offerings, al kol korbanecha takriv melach. On every sacrifice, you need to have salt. And the Torah seems, by the way, just in this short pasuk, seems to be very insistent about this, right? It said it in three different ways that you need to have melach on your korbanos. Notice the last one is more expansive. It's not just minchasecha, not just the meal offerings, but kol korbanecha, all offerings. The mincha is a subcategory of a korban. Korbanos are a very wide range. There's animals, there's birds, there's meal offerings, there's wine libations, there's actually different things that we offer up. It seems to be across the board, and obviously with the exceptions of libations. We're not adding salt to the wine. So how far does this go? Is this a recommendation? Is this good advice? How far does this mitzvah go? So the Gemara actually says, commenting on this, the Gemara in Menachos, tells the following daf Chof Amud Aleph, Tanya Bris Melach Olam Hu Shetahei Bris Amura B'Melach Dir Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says, quoting a pasuk in Bamidbar, that apparently salt is the symbol of an eternal covenant, and that needs to be on the karbonos. Rabbi Shimon is more explicit. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Ne'emar Kan Bris Melach Olam. We know that a covenant of salt is eternal. V'ne'emar lahalon bris kuhunas olam, and we know that the covenant of priesthood is eternal. Keshem she'iyav shal karbonas b'loy kuhuna, kach iyav shal karbonas b'loy melach. Just in the same way that if you don't have a priest facilitating the sacrificial service, it doesn't work. So too, if you have a sacrificial service void of salt, it doesn't work either. That's how far it goes. And in fact, with the way the Rambam codifies this in halacha. The reason, by the way, we need to look to the Rambam for codification of this, is the Rambam paskins all halacha. The Rambam codifies in his 14 books, in his Yad, every single halacha, even halachas which are not practically relevant today, including karbanos. So when you open up a Shulchan Aruch, you're not going to find this, because the Shulchan Aruch is speaking to a diaspora jury, is speaking to a jury post-Churban. Okay, that the Shulchan Aruch is only four sections. The Rambam is the place we look to for halachas, even for the future. And the Rambam paskins very clearly that if a person does not put salt on the korban, then a person actually gets malchus, right? This is a transgression of a lav, of a prohibition not to have melach on the korban. And we have to ask ourselves, why? Why is this so important? There aren't so many ingredients, right? When it comes to menachos, there are some primary ingredients. There's flour, there's oil, there's some frankincense, right? But salt is integral. When it comes to the meat, there's very, very little else we're adding to the meat. In fact, there's restrictions as to anything else you add to the meat, but suddenly salt is so important. So the question is, why? Why is this so significant? Why is this the starting point of korbanos? Hang on for just a second. I want to just put out a few ideas first and then come back to the question more broadly, because there's a few historic trends and then there's more practical trends. Just historic trends which don't really explain it. They just sort of emphasize this. One or two historic twists which are interesting. And this I'm going to put out here as something which is worth thinking about, and I'm not sure what the answer really is to this. Rashi on the Torah says the following comment, the Bartanura as well on the Torah. Bartanura, in fact, is a city in Spain. That was not his name. It happened to be his name was Rav Ovadia, and he lived in Bartanura, and we call him the Bartanura, you know. So before the wine industry started and all the other things that came from Bartanura, when we talk about Bartanura, the only thing we really think about is the Pirush on the Mishnayos and the Torah. So that's this is what he says. He says Melach in source 7, Melach Bris Shabris Karusa la Melach Shehuftachu Maim Tachtonim, that this is a covenant to the waters. What waters? The lower waters, of course. He says Pirush Shekesha Omar Hakadosh Baruch Hu Yehi Rakia V'Imavdil Ben Maim LaMaim Nisra'amu Hamayim HaTachtonim. When Hashem said, let there be a firmament, I love that word, it really explains very well, right? Let there be a firmament in the middle, right? So, practically speaking, on day two, when there's a division between the lower waters and the upper waters, that's when Hashem says this rakia is going to separate between the two of them. So, the lower waters had a complaint against God. They said, V'amru, Manishtanach mechavrenu, liyos rechokim mikisei hakavod. How is that we are more distant from the throne of glory? Now, just practically speaking, you know, if you ask anybody 200 years ago, where is Hashem, we'd always say upwards, right? So you go to the skies, and that's where Hashem is. And that's obviously an orientation we always think about. We always look up when you think about Hashem. It's a little more complex of a relationship, right? Because today we've seen through the skies, and as the astronomers of the early 1800s would say, we've looked to the heavens and we've not found God there, right? So obviously this orientation is more of a metaphysical orientation rather than a physical orientation. But nonetheless, that is an indicator that Bereshis is not just simply a physical description. They felt more distant from God, right? The lower waters, whether that means orientation or metaphysical orientation, they felt more distant from God. So they said in response to that, the Midrash says that therefore Hashem says, don't worry, we will the korbanos will in fact come with salt on them as a reparation for the separation from me. Which is fascinating, just fascinating on so many levels. It's very hard to understand that because remember it was the water that had the complaint. Now it is true that the low waters are unique in the sense that they're salty as opposed to the rain waters. But it's interesting that the salt, the differentiating factor, is that which comes onto the onto the Mizbeach. Just food for thought as to what that really means. What's the Medrash really trying to get at? Just learn, leave that out on the table to think about the origins. This is obviously a deeply metaphysical concept that the Medrash is talking about. What it means 100%, I don't fully grasp yet. Nonetheless, that's a starting point. Interesting. That's very interesting. So in many ways, a bris is often a split, as we're about to witness in a few minutes after the shir. And starting the bris ben Absarim was a split between and the idea of separation and connection. I want to come back to the idea of separation and connection later on, which is actually a very, very coherent thought. A few other things in history. There's a few historical perspectives on this. The Rambam famously says in Moreh Nevuchim that the korbanos are what? What's the function of korbanos?
Kabar.
No. What does the Rambam say? In the Moreh Nevuchim.
Carbon kavakare.
So you guys are wonderful. This is not the Rambam says. The Rambam says.
To give us an outlet for.
Okay, so what the Rambam says is, I mean, this is the reason why we don't know this, is a shocking thing the Rambam says, is the Rambam says in Moreh Nevuchim is that the Hashem was speaking to a world which was very much connected to polytheistic worship. And so what Hashem did was Hashem redirected those urges of polytheistic worship into the sacrificial service, but towards God with differences. Now, it happens to be that there's a contradiction in the Rambam, because the Rambam does not say that at the end of Hilchos Me'ilah when describing the Karbonos. There, the Rambam says, we have no idea the metaphysical capacity of Karbonos, and we shouldn't really try to imagine it. So the Rambam himself is talking on many different levels. People wonder why it is that the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim says one thing, and the Rambam in Hilchos Me'ilah says another thing. Some people say that maybe he's talking to the Nevuchim, the confused in the Moreh Nevuchim. Not so clear. The Rambam is talking to a very educated audience on a Torah level in the Moreh Nevuchim. Nonetheless, in that context, the Rambam says the following. He says, therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu subtly differentiates the korbanos of the Jewish people from the sacrifices of the nations around. The nations around would have all kinds of extra stuff added to their korbanos. We are very, we'll call it, you know, very extreme, very regulated. We would add salt, which would be the only thing we would add to the korbanos to differentiate ourselves from what was going on in the wild orgies of the West in those days, right? So this is the way he would do it. But again, this doesn't really explain essentially or inherently what it is. He's saying rather, he would say, meaning socially, that this is what's happening. Very fascinating description. Similarly, if you look at the works of Shadal, Rav Lutzato on the Torah, as an example, take a look in Source 8. This is what he says. Again, it's not going to help us understand it, but it's going to help us understand it socially. He says the following, Melech Bris Elokecha, Ad Hayom Hazeh, he says, till this very day. Now, the Shadal is living, I believe, in the 1700s, the late 1700s, and he says the following: Ada yamaze nesiei ha'aravim kashakarsim bris meviim klei shekli shel melach va'oichlim yachad pas v'melach. So he says that the tradition is even in between great Arab leaders today, when they make a covenant in the Middle East, they'll bring a dish of salt and they'll dip their bread in salt as a sign of consummation of covenant. Right, so again, he's not explaining why it's there, but he's saying it happens to be. You see, covenants are made over salt, and the korbanos, in a certain sense, are an aspect of covenant. That bris elokecha, that the covenant of your God with salt, but nonetheless, that it has to be accompanied with salt. Again, this is not an inherent explanation. This is rather a social ramification of what he of this idea. So the question then comes back. We're really essentially back to square one. It is true that the Bartanura and Rashi have told us this harkens back to day two of creation. But looking at the Rambam, looking at the Shadal, we don't necessarily gain a more of a clear explanation as to why it is the salt is to be used. So now just putting it out there, any suggestions before we go further? David, yeah.
Salt absorbs down, and one's forbidden to eat blood.
Good, okay, good. So I want to come back to that in just a second. So the absorption of salt and blood. It is interesting because just for a quick moment, are you allowed blood on the altar? Well, of course. There's lots of blood on the altar, okay? So in fact, you pour blood onto the altar. So it is interesting. So you're right. We're going to get to the kashrus aspect of it in a second. But it is interesting. It might not be to remove blood, but this might be the absorption and might be a very interesting point. Another thought, yeah.
A social aspect, in a nutshell, in Masechet Brachot, when the poor man comes in to eat his bread with salt, so it's raised, when does one say the Shema in the evening, when the priests come in to eat Terumah, but the social connectedness to even the poor person who comes in to at the end of a long day of eating, like we saw.
I hear you. Okay, good. So I mean, that is the common practice. I want to come back to the common practices. The common practice will be an outcome of the essential. Let's just think about some of the properties of salt for just a moment. Some of the properties of salt. Salt, what was that?
It's not rot.
It is not rot. Okay, that's interesting. So salt is used as a preservative. Okay, so that's an interesting point I'll come back to. So salt itself does not rot, and salt is used as a preservative. When you go on long ships in the days of exploration, when the Spanish, the Portuguese, the English, the Dutch were all exploring around the world, how were their men survive? Now it's salted meat, and that's why they all died of scurvy, because they didn't realize they needed a supplementary diet. But nonetheless, they would use salt to preserve the meat, to preserve the food that would survive for these journeys. Now let's just think about this for just a moment. There are a few interesting properties that salt has, and they have some certain halachic ramifications. One is, and coming back to David's point, I just want to just think about some of the properties and see if we can import them back in. One aspect of it is that salt absorbs. Now, I want to be absolutely clear, because I had an opportunity of speaking with our father-in-law and my mother-in-law, who are both biologists, last night, and it's not exactly true that salt absorbs. What actually happens is, to be clear, salt is a catalyst for a process called osmosis, which means to say, just to appreciate how this works, salt, or classic salt that we have today, there are many salts, right? Salt is a product of a chemical reaction. There are many salts. The salt that we talk about is generally NaCl, which is sodium chloride, right? That's a basic salt, the natural occurring salt. There's obviously a lot of other elements in it, but the basic salt is sodium chloride, the mixture of these two elements. And they form a latticework. There's a crystal in which the negative and the positive ions are surrounded by one another. So we have this crystal-like structure of salt, and when it comes into contact with water, it's extremely soluble. We'll see in just a second some aspects of that halachically. So soluble, so it now dissolves into the water, which means to say that the water, which is a polar substance, because the oxygen and hydrogen molecules are on the one side positive and the one other side negative, they are a polar substance, now absorbs or is actually encases as it dissolves the salt. And there's the process of osmosis is that a water or a substance, or in this case water, will always move from a low concentration to a high concentration until there is equilibrium in the other way around, from low high concentration to low concentration in order for there to be equilibrium, which means that when you have, let's say, when you put salt onto meat, what ends up happening is that the surface layer of the salt dissolves in the water or the liquid of the meat. And because now that is a very highly concentrated area of, we'll call it water and salt, then the rest of the water surges towards it in order to create an equilibrium until all of the water has mixed together the salt. Now there's equilibrium in terms of the substance. Now, this is interesting because we use that. So in a halachic sense, as David is pointing out, we do see this in halacha. Take a look at source 13 for a second. The idea of salt. Now, when I wrote this, I used it as a property called absorption. It's not absorption. It's actually osmosis, where we see in halacha that this applies to every meat that we eat, not korbanos necessarily. The halacha is, in source 13, the Rambam, in Hilchos Ma'acholos Asuros Perek Vav, Ein abasar yotze midei damai, elo imkein molcha, yofe yofe. You cannot eat meat unless you've salted it very well. There's two yofes in there. That means well, right? So he says, umedicho yofe yofe, and you need to wash it off as well. Okay, so how does the process work? Mediach abasar tchila, v'achakach molcha, yofe yofe, umanicha b'molcha, kidei hiluch mil. So what you do is you first wash it very well. The Rambam is clearly being very specific about the wellness of this. It has to be washed very well. Then it needs to be covered in salt and left for the amount of time it takes to walk a meal. There's a machlokes haposkim, generally speaking today. Generally, it's supposed to be at about an hour. That's more than that. And then you wash it very well. And then you wash it off and you put it into boiling water. The idea is that you want to seal it off from any more blood coming out, and once the process has been achieved, we assume that all blood is left, which is why sometimes, you know, when you're cutting up your chicken, you see, oh, look, there's like a red substance. We're not ever concerned about blood, because once the salting process has happened, we understand that all blood, all halachic blood is left. Anything else left behind is not considered blood halachically. And in the converse, if the process was not done well, for example, if a person did not wash it beforehand, and just added salt, we assume that the blood, that in fact the salt remained in, that the blood in fact remained inside. It's a very critical process, which we do for our meat. It's interesting that we don't generally do this part of the process because we already buy it already salted. But for those you remember, for livers, right? You know, those who had to learn how to salt livers is not so simple. But today we have the luxury of having a lot of this done for us. But this is part of the halachic process. This is one of the aspects where salt actually catalyzes osmosis. One of the interesting things that is an additional level to this is the following halacha. And this is just something worthwhile thinking about in terms of what salt's doing. The halacha is, as the Gemara in Chulin on Kuf Yud Beis says, in the name of Shmuel, is that meliach ha-kerosayach, that something which is undergoing the process of salting is as if it's boiling. What does that mean? So just a very simple example. In general, in kashrus, there is no interchange of taste unless you have heat. That's the general idea. There's a few exceptions to this. So let's imagine that we had two pieces of meat here. So let's say we have a treif piece of meat and a non-treif piece of meat. So let's say this is the treif piece of meat, and it comes in contact and sits next to a kosher piece of meat. So what do you do? Now I want to remove the kosher piece of meat, and I want to eat it. What do I need to do?
Scrape water.
So the area of contact, there's a surface contact. So the area of contact I need to clean off, scrape off. I need to make sure that anything that was touching is removed, and I'm able to eat the kosher piece of meat, because we understand that if without a heat interchange, there's not going to really be a interchange of taste on a deeper level. But now, should I have these in the oven next to each other? Right, should I have these in the pot next to each other? Now it's going to be more serious. And if there's liquid, they're even more serious because there's more of an absorption. And now we start talking about not just surface level, but what's called kedei netila, which is like a sort of an incision in the area of contact, or kedei kuloi, meaning if there was sufficient amount of interchange, the entire thing becomes treif, unless you have a volume which is much more significant than the treif piece of meat. So you need heat for that interchange to happen. What the Gemara tells us is that if the treif piece is not just a treif piece of meat, but let's say it's a piece of meat which is undergoing the process of salting. So you have blood in here, and you have the salt on it. So it's now salting, and the process of osmosis is occurring. And now I put it next to a piece of kosher meat. Technically speaking, are they both cold? Yes, technically speaking, right? But the Gemara is telling us that because meliach, whilst in the process of salting, is kiroseach, it's like it's boiling. That means to say now we have to be concerned to a certain degree that the kosher piece of meat is not only affected on a surface level, it's actually affected more totally. And there's a big debate in the poskim as to how far it affects it. Depends on what kind of meat we're talking about on the kosher side. Very complicated. Is it shuman? Is it kachosh? There's a very large debate about this, but certainly not just on a surface level. Why is that? It's interestingly enough, there is actually a release of energy as this process is going on. We view this as that there is a heat exchange which is happening, and this is expressed halachically in this in this halacha. What a complicated halacha. This is to be found in the halachas that anybody who gets smicha needs to learn in Simon Kuf Hei in Yerodah 105. This is all the halachas of treif, kosher, and treif. This is one of the basic halachas that a person needs to go through. It's a very complicated halacha, very extensive simon. Nonetheless, that's another interesting process of salt, is that while the chemical reaction is happening, there is a heat interchange which is expressed in halacha. One aspect of it. The other aspect which is interesting, another chemical property of salt, which is applicable halacha, is that the fact that it's soluble. So as an example, you'll see a number of times where we treat salt in a way where it's very similar to water. Here's an example. In the famous 7th parak of Mikvahs, as an example, we're talking about substances which can help contribute towards the cleanliness of a mikvah. Right, to the filling up of a mikvah. A mikvah in its natural form needs to be at least 40 seah of water. And the Mishnah tells us in Source 15, this is in Mikvahs Perek Zayin Aleph, this is usually learnt in shiva houses, and so this is something which should be familiar, is Yesh Malins HaMikvah V'loi Poislin, there are substances which bring up, which complete a mikvah and do not poisle it, then there are those which are poisle, not male, and there are those which are Loi Malin V'loi Poislin, don't complete it and don't detract from it. Elo Malin V'loi Poislin, these are substances which complete a mikvah but don't invalidate it. Hasheleg, snow, of course. Borod, hail, of course. Hakfor, frost or ice. Haglid, right? Vamela, va titanorok. Isn't it interesting that we consider salt stones as part of this. Now, clearly, these are natural forms of salt stones, where you can imagine you're going along, let's say, where you go towards, let's say, the Dead Sea today, and you go into the salt basins. That means to say it's soluble enough, we treat it, let's say you were to throw one of those stones into a mikveh, and it had sufficient volume to bring the mikveh from an incomplete to a complete status, that would actually complete the mikveh. Isn't that interesting? Meaning to say that's how close we treat it on the soluble level to water itself. Another example of solubility is on Shabbos, Hilchos Shabbos. This is practical halacha on a regular Shabbos, and that is putting salt into hot water, cooking, right? So in the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Shin Yud Ches talks about this. What happens if you have a kli rishon, even a kli sheni, and you which is the yad soled esboy? Can you put certain substances into this? So that, taking a look at this, here we go. The Shulchan Aruch says in source 16, kli rishon. Let's say you have a kli rishon, so I have a pot which was used for cooking water, and I take it off the fire, so it's now still hot, right? You can't put in it any spices because it's going to cook the spices. So he says that the Shulchan Aruch paskens you can add salt to this. You can't put even salted meat into here. So there's a debate as to whether you can put salt, whether you can cook salt in a boiling liquid or not, in a kli rishon or a kli sheni. Part of that is how much of the process, how much are you cooking, how much is it absorbing, how fast is it absorbing over here? Is it considered in the category of something which is called kalei habishal, which is easy to cook or not easy to cook? It's interesting that salt's actual melting point is very, very high. But nonetheless, its cooking, in terms of halacha, may be very low. Another example of where you see the solubility of salt affecting halacha. The question is how does that really help us? Meaning, so these are interesting aspects of applications in halacha, but how does it really help us understand what's going on the carbonus? It isn't exactly the same relationship, right? On the carbonus, we're not talking necessarily about it in a process of osmosis, because blood is allowed in the mizbeach. We're not talking about solubility necessarily, right? Because the point of water or not water being there on the mizbeach is not necessarily integral to the carbon process. So what's really going on? Why is this necessary? So there are a couple ideas I'd like to develop with you right now and think carefully about. And then come to a more broader conclusion. The one is the following. The Sefer HaChinuch says, so he has a very interesting theory. Actually, he has two theories about the idea. Coming back to the Karbonos. What is it about the Karbonos that need Melach? What is it to teach us about ourselves? So the Sefer HaChinuch points out the following basic assumption about a Karbon. I think somebody mentioned this beforehand. And that is that a Karbon is supposed to represent, in a certain sense, a self-sacrifice process. Meaning, the way the Ramban says it, somebody mentioned this beforehand, and I think mentioned this, is that when a person is bringing a korban, you can imagine this is a pretty graphic experience. You know, when you go up to it's not like going to the farmyard. You know, this is like the slaughterhouse. You're seeing, you know, a huge live entity now ending its life in front of you, and you're the different parts. It's stripped of its different parts. The innards are taken one place. The different parts of the meat are taken a different place. There's hooks. It's being cut up. It's now being taken. Parts of it are being brought onto the mizbeach, and you're witnessing this, right? This is a very graphic experience where the Ramban says is that you should be thinking to yourself, well, I really should be there, right? I mean, say my blood, my innards, my fat should be on the altar, and this is supplanting my self-sacrifice by vicariously experiencing it through this animal. That's what's supposed to be happening. And for a person who's sensitive, this can be a transformational experience. into that mixture, says the Sefer HaChinuch, we throw in salt, because in the process of self-correction, apparently salt is necessary. Why is it such? So he says, because salt, in a certain sense, brings the substance or brings the meat to perfection of taste. Not so much about the meat, the blood aspect or taking out the blood. It brings the actual item to its own perfection of taste. And I'd like to add to that a little bit as well, an idea which I think we know and we've heard before, but this is just such an important point, is that you're not allowed to put other things on the korban. Example is, you can't bring devash, you can't bring honey on a korban. Why not? Let's think about this for a second. If taste, as the Sefer HaChinuch says, is such a crucial aspect of the korban, so let me add in, you know, my mom's favorite recipe of korban. You know, it's like, you know, the Beis Yaakov cookbook korban. You know, it's like the back section there. You know, for the Bimos Mashiach Bimherev Yomenu. You know, and they said, you know, we always love to add, you know, to add coriander. You know, the halacha is you can't add anything to the korban except for salt. Why is that? So dvash is a preservative, but the interesting thing is what does the dvash do? Dvash adds an external taste to the korban, right? It adds something external, which is now, in a certain sense, mixing in to what should be this korban experience. Whereas, what is salt doing? Salt is not doing that. Salt is actually extracting the natural flavor. So what the korban process is trying to do is to the human onlooker or bystander who's supposed to be experiencing this process of like of self-contrition and experiential change is now witnessing the process where Hashem says, yeah, put a little bit of salt there, because what I'm asking you to do is I'm not asking you to be anybody else. I'm not asking you to now absorb from somebody else. I want you to be able to change yourself from within yourself. And the process that does that is salt. So I want you to, in yourself, think about the salt in your life. What are you going to do to bring out the capacities in yourself, the successful aspects of your life, and the parts which are not so successful to tone down? That's what the part of it is. That's what the Sefer HaChinuch says. So it's a self-learning process which is going on. Then the Sefer HaChinuch takes it to the next level. Level two. And that is what somebody mentioned beforehand. And that is, Elliot mentioned, is the preservative aspect of salt. So take a look at this. At the very bottom of Sefer HaChinuch on page 3, very, very bottom of source 9. He says, about 5 lines up from the bottom is a period, and he says the following on the left-hand side in the Hebrew. He says, "Milvad ze yesh b'melach inyan acher romeis." There is another aspect of salt which is important, which is being hinted to. Ki ha-melach mekim or makayim kol davar, it preserves substances, u'matzil ala hefsed v'ala rikavon. It prevents rotting or decay to occur. So the korban is supposed to be activating the emotions where we think about how do we preserve ourselves? What is that we need to do to preserve ourselves? No, Walt Disney. That's not the answer, right? So apparently we need to be thinking about what it is that we need to do to preserve ourselves. Right? How do we get eternity? The answer is, well, there's certain actions which we can click into eternity. And there's certain actions which take us away from that. The salt is supposed to be there to remind us. That's a very fascinating idea. Of course, salt as a preservative is being used and accentuated to teach us the lesson of how we attain eternity. But here's the issue, folks. This is the real issue that I'm struggling with. And it really sort of accentuates the difficulty here. As wonderful and as preservative salt is, and as much as it's the idea of eternity, that it keeps things going and it doesn't rot itself, at the same time, it's also corrosive. Isn't that interesting? Salt is a very destructive thing too. Example, the first time it really appears in the Torah is? Right, is Lot's wife. Let's take a look backwards. I moved out of order because just for a different perspective. What happens? The whole of Sodom and Amorah is being destroyed. And they're escaping. They're trying to get to Tzoyar. And Lot is makes a change of plans. At this point in time, he's told not to look back. Vatabet ishtoi ma'acharov. She looks behind him. By the way, it's interesting. It's not ma'achorecha. It's behind him. Just why is that? Just food for thought. She looks behind him. And what happens? Vatahi netziv melech. And she becomes a pillar of salt. And yes, when you go to Israel today, the tour guides will take extra money to be able to show you the pillar of salt of Lloyd's, right? And they've earmarked that. There's a picture of it on the bottom of the page here. We're not 100% sure that that's Lloyd's wife. But nonetheless, she turns into salt. Why? Why did she turn into salt? So famously speaking, when we're educated in day school, we're taught Rashi. Rashi says, and quoting the Midrash, that what happens is that she was actually, when Lot had the guests arrive, they were going to borrow salt, and she had a negative attitude towards borrowing the salt. Why is that we have to have guests? And because of that, midah keneged midah, so to speak, she turned into the salt that she resented getting to host the guests. That's sort of a spiritual perspective of it. On a basic perspective, why did she turn into salt? Without getting fancy, why did she turn into salt out of all things? That's what was happening, right? Meaning to say, what was happening at this point in time? in Bereshis, we only hear about what's called the idea of this gofris, which was this tar which was raining from heaven. But when you read in Sefer Devarim, the description of that area, as it is today, is gofris for melach serefa kol artsa, right? It was a place which was now heavily salted. And as we go today, lifeless. In the sunken region of the Dead Sea, which was destroyed and turned over, literally, as the Tanakh tells us, by God, what's an expression of distraction, of lack of life, is salt. So the fact that she turned around, it wasn't that it was a punishment, it was simply a consequence. If you're tarrying while that's happening, you are now going to succumb to the circumstances, and she turns into what happened to everybody else there. Right, just to think about it. So it's not like, you know, she's getting told off for this. She wasn't fast enough, ultimately. That's what the Bechor Shor and many of the other, the Mefarshei Pshat suggest. Which means to say, if you think about this, and by the way, this happens elsewhere in Tanakh, when you see people in Tanakh who want to really destroy a city, Avimelech, Shechem, later on, when you see people who really want to destroy an area, what do? They plow it first, that's the first level, and then they salt it. What's the salting? The salt is now essentially dehydrating all life forms. There's nothing's going to grow there. They're essentially destroying it irrevocably. And that's what Hashem did. Hashem destroyed the Dead Sea. Till today, nothing's growing there. Now, there's no aquatic life. It's all dead. So isn't it interesting? The greatest preserver is this at the same time. The greatest corrosive... I mean, like, think about the bottom of our cars every time it gets turns to winter. How many times do we have to replace, you know, the chassis of the old cars because of the salt on the roads, right? Meaning, it's corrosive. It destroys. At the same time, it preserves. Is that interesting? So it might be, later on the Farshim say, well, that's exactly the point. The very dual nature, the very fact that it actually has both elements in it, is the reason it's used. Is that interesting? So an example, the Ksav HaKabbalah, Rav Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg. I was very excited to hear about this because my name is Yaakov Tzvi. And so Rav Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg lived in the 1800s, and he wrote a pirush called the Ksav HaKabbalah on the Chumash. In that he says, well, the reason why we use salt is because salt is of a contradictory nature. Now, he happens to be talking on a level where he's talking about the physics of that he was had access to at the time, which is that salt is a product of both fire and water. Now, that might be on a metaphysical plane, on a physical plane, that's not necessarily the case. But he says the reason is because we are trying to show that we're not serving one specific chemical category. Right, we see Hashem through complexity. That's the way he looks at it, which is a very fascinating idea. I want to add on a chemical level, he may not have been aware of this at the time, but just to appreciate this, salt is a very safe substance, right? Sodium chloride is a safe substance. It's table salt, we even call it. We put it on our tables, it's all right. But the actual substances it comes from are extremely dangerous substances by themselves. They're not natural occurring substances. Sodium. Sodium by itself has to be preserved in alcohol, because when you put sodium into water or potassium, as an example, the element right underneath it on the periodic table, it explodes because it reacts so fast. It means they are very dangerous things. If you put sodium on your tongue, it'll sink through your tongue through the bottom of your jaw. I'm saying, like, we're talking about pretty dangerous substances alone, but in its pure form. Then, if you take chlorine by itself. Well, who used chlorine? The Germans in the First World War, chlorine gas is heavier than air. It goes across the ground. That's what they use in trench warfare. Chlorine gas doesn't just suffocate a person. It reacts in your lungs in a way that you suffocate yourself internally. It's a chemical reaction. It's a terrible thing. You put the two together and boom, let's make hamotzi. Right? So if you think about that, think about what that means. Is here we're taking something which is internally contradictory, right? We talk about two dangerous elements come together. Now you have a safe substance. You talk about something which whether it be metaphysically, as you're saying, or in terms of its properties, corrosive and preservative at the same time, and that's where the covenant is. In fact, in a tziv, Rav Natali Tzvi Berlin adds one extra dimension to this. And he says, interestingly enough, this is in source 12, I'm not going to do the whole thing over here, but I would encourage people to have a chance to read this if you're able to. In your own time, just to read this, he says, that's exactly how Hashem works in the world. Hashem doesn't work in black and white ways. It's not clear. Everything, this is absolutely good, this is absolutely bad. There is no thing in the world which is absolutely one way or another. Everything which is bad has something which, unfortunately, has good to it. Everything which is good has negative aspects to it. In fact, he says a lot of bad experiences yield good experiences. Not all the time. Right? Famously, Yaakov says to the Malach, Lo yashlechacha ki im berachtani. I'm not going to let this negative experience go until I found the bracha in it. There has to be something. Says the Netziv, HaKadosh Baruch Hu reminds us of the way he works with the world by on every korban we put melach. Because melach itself is a contradictory element. Where there's a little bit of bad, there's a little bit of good. It preserves, it corrodes, it destroys, it brings life. What, how do we look at it? That's exactly the melach, the bris that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is making with us. In fact, the covenant itself demands that. A covenant is something which can preserve, can help us, and if we step one foot over that line, can destroy us. It's the same thing, because that's the complexity of dealing with Hashem. That's the complexity of real life. It's not one way or another. That's what the Netziv says, which I think is so tenable. Take it one step further into our own lives as well. This is why it is that, in fact, the Gemara says is that the Gemara compares the bris melach to the bris of Yisurim. Isn't it interesting? The Gemara says that the covenant of salt is like the covenant of Yisurim, of suffering. The way the Gemara says it in Source 17 is, V'hano de Rabbi Shimon ve'lakish, Dom Rabbi Shimon ve'lakish, ne'emar bris melach ve'ne'emar bris be'yisurim. There's a covenant made by salt and a covenant made by Yisurim, by suffering. Ne'emar bris ve'melach, tichsiv v'lo tashvis melach bris alakecha. That's by the Korbanos, the Ayar Pasuk. V'nema bris b'yisurin tichsiv ele divrei abris. When it talks about the curses in Devarim, it says these are the words of the covenant. Ma bris ha'amur b'melach, melach m'matekes as abasar. Just as the covenant of salt sweetens the meat, af bris ha'amur b'yisurin yisurin m'markines kolvanos ha'shel adam. Remember that the suffering as well also has an element of the positivity, which brings out, it cleanses, it kills the bacteria. It enables us to get further, which is again the Netziv's idea, which is the complexity of the of it. Where do we see this? We see this in a practical halacha, and that is that on the table, every time we have bread, not just on Shabbos, we should really have salt. Why is that? The Shulchan Aruch Paskins is in Simon Kuf Samach Zayin Sifhei. Why is this? Says the Shulchan Aruch. Well, on the one hand, is because the table is like the Mizbeach. So in a sort of a parallel fashion, what we're doing is we're having the salt like we would have on the Mizbeach. However, the Shulchan Aruch adds one element at the end. Take a look in Source 19, the last source. Starting from the third last line, in the way it says, Hagah, Mikomoko mitzvah lahavi al kol shulchan melach kodem sheyivtsoya ki ha-shulchan domeh le-mizbeach v'achila le-korban. So we are commemorating our eating like the korban and remembering all these ideas while we have the salt on the table. V'ne'emar al kol korbanecha takriv melach, our pasuk, which is why we have the salt on the table when eating bread. However, he adds one fastest following line. Then he says, "V'megin mina puranos." It also protects us from puranos, from punishment. What does that mean? The Mefarshim say, quoting back to where the Saru appears in the Hagoyas Ashri, which is where it's said in the parentheses. You know what it is? Is that when there's a time at the table where we're silent and we're not speaking, the Satan is makatrek. The Satan says, "Look, there's a deficiency of zechuyos, because we're not talking Dibre Torah." Now, sometimes I wonder to myself if the silent part of the meal is actually the best time of the meal in terms of zechuyos, because of what else might go on at the table. But nonetheless, the assumption is over here is that the meal is going to be a time replete with Dibre Torah, replete with growth and connection, and this time is a time which is devoid of connection. So what do? We have salt there which reminds Hashem of the covenant that we have with him. Because ultimately, it is the greatest protector as well as the greatest destructor. Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting. Very interesting. Very good. So, yeah, and that's a good point. So what Baruch is saying is that if you have a meal without the Divrei Torah, it's like Zivich HaMesim, it's like the Korban, which was not shechted correctly, which is unfortunately a terrible place to be. Nonetheless, this is the complexity. These are some of the ideas which are all interplayed in the salt, and we commemorate on a daily, if not weekly, basis as we have a salt. Message, and we should be zoicheh to be able to see the real institution b'mehera v'yameinu. Rabbi Chanan Nakashu Moratzah, Gosh Baruch Hu, Lezakos Yisrael, Lefichach Yir, Balaim Torah, Mitzvah, Shnei Mar, Nechovetz, Amantzikoh, Yagdil, Torah, V'yadir.